So we're going to switch gears here and get into some talk and music with Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective.
That Ray Charles song was recorded out of anger. Have you ever seen
that
movie?
That particular song? Really?
Yeah.
Really? No, I didn't know that at all. Oh, you guys got your CD? You okay? Okay. Hi. And so it's a change in DJ teams here and a little bit in format. And so welcome, listeners far and wide. Today's show, we're going to be talking a lot about local elections, or more specifically, some ballot questions, referendum questions on the ballot in what's being known as the midterm elections. And even though we're going to take a local Massachusetts-based look at those, we are also talking about, we'll be talking about the country as a whole, the U.S. as a whole, which is going into these midterm elections with, you know, a lot of attention being paid and a lot of corporate media propaganda being used to get people interested. Midterm elections in the United States are usually low turnout affairs, and people don't see much importance in them. I would argue that mostly because they don't see much difference between the Republicans and the Democrats on a lot of issues. There are differences, but on a lot of especially economic issues, if your local Democratic Party city council, which most major cities in the coasts have, for example, if they are going to close your local school down, or claim there's no money for education, or claim there's no money, put forward an austerity budget in many different ways in terms of mass transit, schooling, whatever the issues are that you're interested in. Nothing we can do about healthcare, all that stuff. Then you don't tend to like Democrats so much either, if you're awake and thinking about what's going on. So the midterms, especially, where there is usually less hype about them, although still a lot, people often don't bother voting. Then presidential elections every 4 years, a lot of people really get sucked into the kind of personalities. You know, I like so and so running for president. I don't like so and so. And even though the issues, again, tend to be in many cases similar, sometimes that's not obvious, but and there are differences too. But mostly what I'm getting at is we have no mass independent or third party, however you want to talk about it, political choice here in the United States on a national level. Locally, sometimes there is a clear alternative to the left of the Democratic Party, or unfortunately to the right of the Republican and Democratic parties. But not every independent is necessarily progressive. But anyway, so we're going to get into the ins and outs of this current election cycle, ask if anything will really be different the day after, because there should be a change there based on the polling data and so on. There should be a change in one corporate political party taking over from another corporate political party in terms of the House of Representatives. The Democrats should be taking over. And why I'm going into this from like a bit of a distance in terms of description, explaining some basic stuff that many of our listeners already know, is that we do have listeners from other countries, and we want to, you know, let them know why we're spending time talking about these elections, and they are important. They're not result in any sort of fundamental change, but they are important as a indicator of mood at the moment of the elections, at least as an indicator of, corporate political strategies, and will expectations go up or go down? Will this result in deeper illusions in the Democrats, or among progressives and some leftists, unfortunately, or will this be a moment where, see, we got rid of Trump, or we cut into Trump's power, and yet nothing really changed? Now, there's been a lot of those moments, so I kind of don't agree with socialists, leftists, liberals, progressives that claim this is a unique moment in history. It's got its differences. No moment is the same. History does not repeat itself. But there is enough similarities in previous history, especially with the Democratic Party taking a populist turn, that we can say, yeah, the day after, just nothing's going to change. Now, mass movements could if triggered, left to their own devices, if they don't accept Democratic Party leadership, they could force both the Democrats and Republicans to make changes. We're not saying that change is not going to happen. We're just saying it's not going to happen through ticking off one corporate party on a ballot versus another one. Sorry, Diego, what were you going to say? By the way, your host today are myself, Jeff, and
Diego.
And welcome.
Am I on?
Welcome back to you. You're totally on. I can hear you.
All right.
What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
No, I was just watching if anyone... you know, an American Experience, the... that series, that show, you know, different.
The title sounds familiar.
It's WGBH.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching from the library. It was called The Bombing of Wall Street, which I didn't even know that Wall Street was bombed in 1920.
I didn't either. What happened?
So they claim it was an anarchist or whatever. At that time, it was very radical. You know, it was right after the Russian Revolution. They try to pin it on, oh, this is a Bolsheviks uprising.
Bolsheviks would have taken over the stock market and used the furniture.
So they put a cart, you know, supposedly like a cart full of dynamite and TNT, like a powder keg, and just blew up the front of the Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
But unfortunately, a lot of the workers were the victims of this, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So it's not really like something that, oh, you took out all the bankers, you know what I mean? You just took out a lot
right.
of workers.
Right, no, that's terrorism.
Which is what happens, yeah. you know, with yeah. like 9/11 and you know,
yeah,
things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. so that's what...
But there was an angle there
go
of
ahead.
Like...
Go ahead,
not that history repeats itself, but, you know, at that time, it was a radical, you know, the Russian Revolution, and just... the fear that it was going to happen here.
Yep.
And that the workers and the labor is stronger.
Yep.
At well, the time.
The 20s were actually a rough period for labor in the U.S. because 1917, 18, there was a severe repression.
The Palmer Raids.
Yeah.
Yes, they got into that.
And then in the 20s, there was an upswing in the economy, at least for the upper classes, and
it's like the 90s, late 90s, you know,
or like now. So the bosses were very confident. The companies were very confident, and they were making huge profits. And they decided to deal with unionization by just shooting people, basically murdering. They murdered a lot of union activists, and tortured and beat up thousands more. And anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to clarify. You know, history does not repeat itself, but there's some similarities.
Oh yeah, you know, definitely. Yeah. Well, that's one of the main things about Marxism is historical materialism, that you can study history from a point of view of a scientific point of view, like how does a certain society at a given moment, how do they produce what they need to survive, what as a human society, food, clothing, shelter, etc. And each different economic system, there are different ways of producing what's needed. So you had most of human history, the vast majority of human history, a sort of
agrarian,
low-tech, you had a low-tech tribal societies. You could call it communism, but communism on a subsistence level, where the tribes were so linked to the ecology and the environment that they didn't have a lot of surplus. You know, they lived season to season, and, you know, every member of the tribe had an important role to play.
Kind of like what they live in Alaska.
Extreme Alaska. Yeah, I've seen some documentaries lately of even the remotest...
Below zero. Alaska below zero, where they live off the land.
Yeah, yeah, no, I've seen those. Yeah, even the remotest... But even the remotest tribes up there now are sort of infected by capitalism.
Yes.
They you know, and that's not their fault. You have to use the technology you can. I mean, we can never go back to subsistence communism or what was known as primitive communism. I don't really like that term, but... You can't ever go back to that, but it was a very egalitarian, very equal society where there were no prisons, there were no
state
courts, there was no state. It was basically people, if they had disagreements, there was war, but it was much more limited than now. There was no idea of owning land, although there was territory that people got used to using, and they had to make agreements on how to use it, and if they couldn't, there'd be fighting. But I'm not trying to idealize it, but it was also a lot less bloody than any of the subsequent human ways of surviving economically. And so after hundreds of thousands or millions of years of that or whatever, not millions, but hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, I don't know. Anyway, then we get into... agrarian society and domestication of cattle led to the first slave societies. You know, you had a surplus, and then there was who's going to control the surplus. The first religion, the first organized religions were like priests and stuff came out of that. in terms of using that to control. The first states came out of that, using that to control. And then,
also Islam,
and then
did
slave
a lot
labor.
Of that too.
Yeah, and then slave labor became the main mode of production, not the tribal production.
Because I got friends from Morocco that said, I'm Moroccan, but I'm from this tribe.
Yeah.
And the Romans took over at one point.
Yeah.
Islam came in, you know what I mean? It took over, yeah. You know, and pushed us out. And I'm like, you know, all these things I hear now from, you know, all these different cultures going, wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, and
Moroccans all one. No, they're not. They're different tribes, yeah. Different lingos, different dialects, different, you know, customs.
Yeah. And the slave society.
They also had slaves.
The slave thing, yeah, crossed over religious boundaries and what we now know as national boundaries. Then you had feudalism. That, you know, didn't rely on slaves, but relied on serfs, agriculture, you know, and that sort of started to build up a surplus that got concentrated. I'm skipping a lot of important stuff, but it got concentrated in more densely populated areas where some sort of beginning manufacturing started around exploration, as they called it, or colonization, exploration, and war, actually. The more the sort of merchant class emerged that controlled the trade and the fairs and the beginnings of manufacturing, they started to bump heads with the Catholic Church, and this is in Europe, and with the other, the royalty, you know, that controlled things. And that led to all the bourgeois revolutions in Marxist terminology, meaning revolutions that started capitalism. And they had some of them had aspects of also civil liberties and civil rights for the first time. For a narrow section of the population,
but then they became the kings and queens, and
well, the kings and queens. They kept, some societies kept.
They
the kings
replaced and, the queens and kings and said, "Okay, I'm on a throne now."
The economic throne, the capitalist
throne.
Yeah,
I'm a capitalist.
But some of the countries you notice kept the kings and queens. Britain still has that, and they use the monarchy as a sort of fascist.
China, really. Well, not now, but I'm saying back then, even though it was ruled by, let's say, Britain, certain areas.
Oh, yeah, the rest of it had warlords and stuff.
They needed that emperor there, to mediate.
Japan had the emperor until World War II.
Same thing.
Well, what I was going to say was that you had this situation where, when feudalism was overthrown, not every society decided to get rid of its royalty. It depended really on the people. Like in France, people did a very good job of erasing the royalty, and we should thank them for that.
You did a really good job.
Yeah, it was a really
what
good
was
job.
What was that? The Bastille.
They invaded the prison. They liberated the prisoners.
What's it called? Bastille.
And that was brilliant. But other societies like Britain, the royalty hung on. They're still a parasitic.
I got a book on Robespierre.
On a parasitic group in Britain, but they're kept in reserve as sort of a fascist thing if there's a big social unrest, threat of revolution. If you look at the British constitution, they can declare martial law. They can become then their true ruler or whatever and just take over despite they can dissolve parliament. In fact, even in recent times, the British monarchy dissolved the Australian parliament or something. It was weird. I'd have to double check that one, but I think I read that. So they keep these anachronisms around, these seeming like, why would they have the royalty around? Well, they've created a reason for it, which is to create among the population some sort of support for that through mythology and stuff, and to use that politically if necessary. It's very nasty stuff. Some countries that is not a threat, luckily. So now we have capitalism and each successive type of economic system, and they can overlap and all sorts of stuff. They can coexist. Like in the United States, you had the coexistence of a slave society with both beginnings of capitalism and then capitalism full blown. You have some strange hybrids. But the overwhelming thing was, you know, capitalism was emerging out of feudalism, and that has continued to be the dominant political system the dominant economic system, which leads to a certain type of political system. But the point is that each different type of society had different types of making wealth and making survivability happen, making the basic needs of humans at that time, at that level of technology and so on, continue or not, or get to the point where it was not working so well. we reach that point a lot under capitalism, if you look at it from a world scale, or here. Even within the United States. Yeah, you look at people that say capitalism works, you have to say for who, and who does the work, and it's us, you know. And you know, like just today, I was driving in, obsessed with, you know, my personal or my family's financial situation. Here we are in a boom, but we're like just barely hanging on, like a lot of people in the United States. And it's very, very precarious, and there is a possible recession looming. That's one thing about these elections. This election cycle, as they call it, this midterm elections, got away with no big disruption in the economy. Most likely by 2020, although it could survive, it could go longer, but it's very, very possible by 2020 there'll be a recession and a bad one, you know.
Yeah. We're heading back like 100 years ago.
Yeah, like in a lot of ways.
Doesn't repeat itself, but there's patterns. Yeah. Just,
well, the Great Recession of 2007, 2008, even the corporate media was doing some stuff on that.
Ever hit a depression era like it did 100 years ago?
Yeah.
In 29?
No, 30s. Yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is like the Great Recession of 2007, 2008, that even the corporate media has had some stuff on that recently that people are saying, I never climbed out of that. I'm still feeling the effects of that. You know, I lost X amount. I never gained it back again.
That's like you look at Sears now.
Yeah.
They're out.
Yeah.
December 9th.
Yeah, I was thinking more people and working people, but you're right. There's disruptions
like
the in the
retail
economy
right
too.
Now is a bubble. It's like, you know, there's no stability.
Some of it's there's no I totally agree with that. By the way, how's this first track on here? Red intro. Is that good?
Number 10 cuz
10 you want to do 10? Okay. I was just going to say that retail's funny. There's this idea that it's all on the way out. It's no, you know, through technology of Amazon and so on. But there's also this sort of countervailing trend of certain areas where retail's doing very well right now based on the consumption of, you know, upper middle class people and the rich in certain geographical areas, you know. So I was just seeing a show on the news this morning. I unfortunately listen to the corporate media a lot and watch
the corporate
media a
lot. Open, like the South Shore is going to still be open.
There you go.
Because it's probably more, like you said, geographically.
I mean, give you an example near where I live, the Natick Mall. They have this new chain that I'm supposed to know about, but I don't. Some sort of chain about housewares. I don't know what it is, but it's a big chain growing. There's not enough room in the Natick Mall, so they're going to set up a tent type of structure in the mall, like in the middle, you know, in those walkways, because they want to hit that market, you know. So if retail, I mean, that's just one example. I don't mean to be anecdotal about it. There are statistics to back it up. There's regional differences where retail's doing quite well, quote unquote, versus areas where it's a desert. It's disappearing, you know. I'm not saying that either way with pleasure. I don't want to see people lose their jobs, but I also don't see capitalism as a stable system like we were just talking about. It's very precarious and things can change. It's not an unplanned system. I mean, that's one of the basic, if you don't know anything about socialism, it's not your fault. Don't know anything about Marxism, not your fault. They don't really teach it in the schools here. And one of the basic critiques of capitalism that socialists have on a scientific basis is that it's an unplanned system. We have the technology to actually plan economies now. That technology is used for the opposite. It's used for short-term maximization of profit and screw over your competitor as much as you can, not cooperate. And even if you could cooperate, it would take a much bigger plan based on not extracting profit. And because the competition doesn't come from nowhere. Competition or capitalism comes from an ability to more, from a capitalist standpoint, efficiently exploit labor and nature, meaning like, you know, natural resources. So if you compete better, you can exploit more of those things and grow the company, make the company grow. So it's inherent in capitalism. If you had sort of capitalism where you tried to cooperate and share the wealth,
that's not capitalism.
It wouldn't work because another capitalist would say, wait a minute, I have shares in this company, if it's a publicly traded company, so-called publicly traded, I want more profit for that. Or you could be just a privately held company and the capitalist could say, I want more profit for that. I can't get that if I can't get more market share. I can't get that if I can't screw over more workers. I can't get that if I can't find more cheap labor and pollute the crap out of the environment. All I can get that is do those things, and that'll break that agreement. That agreement will just shatter, you know. You know, it's like I used this example before, but there's a documentary out there that I really dislike in some ways called The Corporation. Came out 10 years ago or so.
Because, oh, where they interview the guy who makes rugs?
Yes, exactly.
And he goes,
what was the conclusion at that? That's what I'm going to bring up.
They give him a book, and he goes, yeah. Are you going to, you know, are you changing your mind about this? He's like, he kind of like loftily, you know, didn't answer the good question. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I've seen it. I've seen it on Link TV.
Yeah, well, what I was going to get into was...
So when they interview him, because his product pollutes the environment heavily because of the rubbers and what have you and the dyes.
Yep, exactly. And, it was... What size company was that? Do you remember? It was... Let's say it's a medium-sized company. It wasn't huge, but I don't think it was small. But the point I was going to make was just to cut to the chase.
Oh, it was a division of a company. Because, you know, sometimes... Like you'll have the Gap, but it's under one big company that has
was
a
it?
Gap, banana.
Okay.
And,
I don't know.
And all
I don't know.
Different.
But that's not the point. The point I was going to make was that so you have this like division of a company or company, and the challenge was the whole documentary is about how corporations do this or that and why under capitalism, but it didn't challenge capitalism at all. So it put forward the idea. Implicitly and sometimes explicitly that corporations could act better and therefore help humanity somehow, right? So in their own terms, the documentary completely failed because the person they picked out, this rug person that you talked about, this rug
CEO,
by the end of the show, he had only moved 30% of production to any sort of kind of green technology.
Yeah,
30%. He could, and who knows, he could have been out of business the next day because his competitor didn't care about that. And just went ahead and made higher profits and then took over his company or whatever. You know what I mean? That's the whole point. Capitalism is not a planned system. It's a system that exists on basically the anarchy of the capitalist market, which is based on production, which is based on competition, based on always increasing short-term profits, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just, it's deadly for humanity. I mean, the big question is a lot of socialists are articulating in socialist literature and Marxist literature, which most people don't have access to, unfortunately, or don't find. They could, you know, there's some access to it, but there are basically, there's a lot of talk about the environment, right? Because of global warming and, you know, the weather patterns, pollution issues, etc. And you see these studies come out from the corporate media 20 years until the point of no return on global warming, where we can't, you know, where the humanity can't, or really it's the capitalists, not humanity, that can't, they won't be able to lower carbon emissions enough to survive certain things that will happen to the environment, glacial melt, whatever, that will just, you know, raise sea level, raise temperatures to the point where, like, there's places on the earth now where temperatures are reaching 121 degrees in the summer.
Australia's one of those places.
India, yeah, there's patches like that. And when that happens, everything kind of stops. Like the machinery starts going, people can't really function outside. I mean, you know, it's really, really hard, to put it mildly. So anyway, the point is though,
stops at a certain amount of heat.
Things start to melt down and stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh yeah. I used to work in a big, by analogy, rough analogy. I used to work in a big
bakery
factory, right? But it was a factory, you know, it had assembly lines and with all the different products and, so it would get up to like that kind of temperatures, you know, 110.
I worked at Rovanga.
Yeah,
Bank. Oh,
yeah.
God.
So what
and
happened
heat,
was...
And they can't put any AC on because obviously we need to keep the breads, you know, warm and what have you.
Yeah, so stuff would break down and you'd ask them why, the maintenance guys, and sometimes it would be, a lot of times, the heat. That's all they would say. The heat. It's the heat. They were right. It's the heat. Other times it'd be other stuff, but you know. But anyway, my point is, will humanity survive capitalism? Is it like burning question arising from the type of economic production now, basically? So anyway, I don't remember why we got into the whole different states of history, of economic history. But
we'll talk about the elections and referendums.
Yeah, that's not going to change the day after the elections. Still going to be capitalist mode of production, which is incredibly wasteful, pollutive, exploitive, and a dead end for humanity, but that's not on the cards. I mean, actually, Nancy Pelosi, head of the Democratic Party, said, we're capitalists after all. That's just the way it is, quote unquote. And by the way, I studied that quote carefully because I wrote something recently in a debate about whether or not to support Democrats. And I started with this Pelosi quote, and I read the quote more closely. Turns out a student who I heard was in a social school called DSA, not sure if he really was or not, he said he challenged Pelosi at a public forum or something in New York City on that. But what he said specifically was, he didn't say, will the Democrats become left-wing? He didn't say, will the Democrats can we reform the Democrats? He didn't say what a lot of people think he said. He actually said, the quote was, do you see the Democratic Party's being able to move a little bit left if they regain power in these upcoming elections, meaning the midterms and the 2020 elections? And Pelosi's answer was, chuckle, we are capitalists after all. That's just the way it is. Ha ha. So think about that for a second. The kid was just saying, are you going to do, the implication was, are you going to do some reforms? Like push to go to the left means, you know, do some reforms a little bit. And Pelosi's already pouring cold water on that. And I've been studying this stuff. I've been reading this stuff. Pelosi came out with a statement that business magazines like business platforms like Bloomberg and so on wrote about more recently after that infamous quote, where she said, we're going to go back to a system we tried to implement in 2007 of pay as you go, meaning if you have a program you want, you're going to have to raise the cut somewhere else or find the revenue for it because we're concerned about the deficit, right? This is the Democrats talking now. And so that means tax increases, basically. But when the Democrats talk tax increases, they often talk about them the way the Republicans do, which is everybody pays more taxes. We can't afford more taxes as workers. We're taxed to death. So that becomes very controversial, and the Democrats tend to back off then from tax increases, or they don't want to do it at all. But they don't say, we can just tax the big corporations and the super rich. They don't say that. You know? They did say recently if they get in power, they want to reverse the Trump administration's tax gifts for the super rich, you know, the big corporations, you know, lowering the corporate tax rate to 28% or is it 21%? I forget.
21.
Yeah, I think so. So anyway, and that was interesting because you don't hear, that was like not the usual talk from people like Pelosi in the Democratic Party. So I want to see if they win the House, want to see what happens with that talk, you know? Because I have no confidence whatsoever. Because historically, what happens is when the Democrats get back in after a Republican administration, they run with it. They run with the cuts the Republicans made. They make them worse. Mm-hmm. Or vice versa. When Reagan got in, everyone says that really the beginning and the end was when Reagan got in. Because he attacked PATCO. And this. Reagan was horrible. Reagan was like Trump. Very much so. But Reagan was also working off of massive deregulation that the Carter administration and the liberals like Kennedy and Saugus rammed through in the 70s, in the late 70s. Deregulation of trucking, utility, and all sorts of things. They busted a lot of unions, and that created super profits for the kind of corporations we're dealing with now. And they did that. So when Reagan got in, did the Republicans re-regulate? Of course not. You know, they ran with it. They deregulated more. They caught more.
It was Merrill Lynch's little, you know, in a pocket of Merrill Lynch.
Yeah. Well, there was a big panic in the mid 70s, early 70s, even before there was a big recession in 74, 75. Even before that, businesses were kind of like, hey, you know, we can get together like the mafia. You know, we can get together and we can make more profit because our profit
make
rates.
Make an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah, our profit rates could be even higher. And the irony of that is that they were making enormous profits during the post-war upswing. It was the biggest increase in corporate profits ever. I think it still might hold that title, although recently that might have been surpassed. But it wasn't enough. It's never enough. And they wanted to move away from, you know, what little bit of social welfare existed in the United States then. You know, they wanted to just move away from that. And they couldn't do it overnight. But Carter was a big part of that. Clinton later was a big part of it, ending welfare as we know it. So, and then when Obama got back in, did he replace state-based welfare that Clinton got rid of and that the Bushes went along with? No. So there's people that I know that claim they'd be socialists that are saying the Democrats are going to get back in, they're going to do this, this, and this. There's no historical evidence for that. Now, I'm not saying that they won't do anything. They could do something very splashy and claim that they're going to reverse some of Trump's, I almost said Bush, some of Trump's stuff. But I'm very skeptical of that, actually. And how much? Because during that debate, which was a very small, short-lived debate about tax cuts, right? The Democrats did not complain that much about the decrease in corporate taxes. They complained about other aspects of that tax bill, and they even some of them even said, "Well, we're not against decreasing corporate taxes, blah blah blah, but we're going to vote against Trump's thing anyway." So, how much energy is there going to be in the Democratic Party to really overturn Trump's tax cuts? I don't see it. It's possible, you know, they might need something to, you know, stay in power with. There might be a mass movement that pisses that people are so angry that becomes an issue somehow. Mm-hmm. In that movement, you know, taxes and revenue and stuff. But anyway, so one of the things we wanted to get into today is the upcoming referendum votes here in Massachusetts. And basically, again, there is a link to the Democrats. The Democrats haven't done anything on this issue. So, you know, in other words, so the nurses union in Massachusetts had to find a way to get this issue out there.
Now, did you hear the counter to that?
I've heard many. Are you kidding?
Do you want to be like Canada?
Yes.
Do you want longer waiting periods?
I want to Canada.
I mean, are you serious?
Doesn't necessarily have longer waiting periods.
Why would you even say that? I mean, it's like misinformation.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. Sorry for the shuffling.
And that's
on
Spanish Network. Telling us Latinos to vote no. I'm like, are you serious? ¿Quieres un Cuba? I swear, I'm like, what? Cuba's great compared to this country. You know what I mean? When it comes to healthcare.
Yeah. I agree. Well, let me just set this up a little bit. Question one here in Massachusetts for our listeners from out of state is the Massachusetts Nurse Association, initiated this ballot question to try to increase staffing levels, you know, the number of nurses taking care of patients, because often the greedy for-profit or non-profit hospitals, non-profit doesn't really mean no profit, by the way, they will pressure nurses to take care of more than one, two, three, four, you know, patients or whatever, even in emergency rooms, even in intensive care units, etc.
And it's stressful. I see it at work.
And it's extremely stressful. And
I don't even have time to eat. And I got to get back. Beep, 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 beep. Yeah. And get the little, oh, gosh. You know, it's like, just.
And you and Diego works in a hospital. And there's also.
Serving food to them.
Yeah. And there's also the nurses themselves saying they don't have time. But there's scientific studies showing bad outcomes if you have less patients per nurse and so on. So anyway.
A lot of anger, too. Oh, I don't know how to administer that. Oh, you know, they get, you know. Oh, I forgot to administer this injection. It was very important. Oops.
Yep.
Oops. You know, things like that.
Yep. Well, nurses.
You got so much happening, you know.
Nurses in Massachusetts apparently have the ability to write like a sort of protest note when they feel they're in a dangerous situation like that. And there have been a lot of those, tons of those nurses saying, this is a bad situation. I don't want to, this is going to lead to mistakes and so on.
Yeah. Malpractice.
Yeah. So the question, it's called question one, started by the nurses. And at first it was polling very high in favor, right? Because people saw, more nurses is better healthcare that way. You know, it's sort of a step in the right direction, hopefully on the way to socialized medicine, single payer, whatever.
I know that national health care.
National health care, different ways of saying that. There are some differences in what those mean, but they're basically getting towards where health care is a right, a guaranteed right in society, the way it is even under capitalism in some other societies. So one thing that's been happening in the American economy, including in Massachusetts, which has a lot of hospitals, is that there's been deregulation over the last, you know, decades of healthcare, and there's a lot of just straight up for-profit, heavily deregulated hospitals and healthcare operations. making a ton of money in a country with no national health service, no single payer. So it's privatized, it's private. Even the ones that are declared nonprofit are making huge profits. And it's basically people making a bunch of people getting rich and other people supporting them to be their foot soldiers as management off of sick people. They're getting rich off of sick people, right? And all that kind of basic stuff, more nurses is better for the patients. Management, of course, pressures nurses to take on more work than they should, the way they would in any workplace. Pressure under capitalism, they're always pressuring workers to do more, unless there's been a strike or a strong union or something that kind of puts a check on that, even temporarily. So you basically have some very common sense, important things that people in their guts understand get twisted around by this corporate propaganda. Because if you, a lot of people still watch regular TV, believe it or not, and they get, if they do, they get these a huge amount of ads paid for by these big for-profit hospitals and non-profit hospitals that are making tons of money to bombard people with vote no, and they just lie about it, you know? And the corporate media is biased towards the no, vote no people, the people that don't want more nurses and so on. The hospital representatives, they give them a lot of time and they treat their complete lies as somehow based in reality. You have Sir Charles Faker, the so-called popular governor of Massachusetts, who a lot of liberals are going to vote for, even though he's a straight-up comes from the CEO from the for-profit hospital world.
Pilfrich.
Yeah, exactly, and all those. Yeah, he was Pilgrim, Harvard Community Pilfrich. Health Plan or something. He's also, people don't remember because there's no memory in bourgeois politics and corporate politics. He was the one that he was in charge of the big dig when it went into severe cost overruns and stuff. And then he was CEO either before that or after that or both at Harvard Community Healthcare, Harvard Vanguard or whatever it's called. And he did, you know, cuts there. He got them to make more profit. He gets elected as governor. He comes out against $15 an hour, as we've reported on the show. Diego and I talked to him personally about that. Sir Charles Faker
was with us. He's a nurse.
Seamus was there.
I remember him. Seamus going, sir, what do you think of our increase for the working? I think it's the way. It's fine the way it is.
Well, Charles Faker, who some of our listeners might even be thinking of voting for, which is to your shame, by the way. Charles Faker is against question one, of course. He's against more nurses. That was a given from day one. A few Democratic politicians have come out for it very late and haven't done much for it. One thing I noticed on the streets driving around is that when you see a house with a bunch of Democratic Party, vote for Ray Gonzalez, who's also running for governor in Massachusetts as a Democrat, when you see them with all their signs, you don't see vote yes on one signs. Very rarely. I think I've seen that once, and it was in a union, in front of a union building. So all this, like, connecting the Democrats to this is really false. In fact, this initiative itself, this referendum itself, came because the Democrats would not do anything about this question of how many nurses you need and letting the nurses have a say in this.
So what do you think is going to pass successfully, like the last election with the school question?
Oh, yeah. That was a surprise, though. A lot of people thought that was going to lose. Right now, a lot of people think that this one's going to lose. And because of the onslaught of corporate media. I hold out hope that it's going to win. And let me just read from one of their leaflets here, Safe Patient Limits on Facebook. It's /safe patient limits, all one word. Or there's different stuff. There's a website, safepatientlimits.org, and it's put out by the Mass Nurses Association. So it says, nurses say yes on one, safe patient limits. The hospital industry can easily afford to provide safe patient limits. That's true. In the wake of hospital executives' ludicrous claims about the cost of question one, the fact is this is a multi-billion-dollar industry that can easily afford to provide the safe patient limits and the quality of patient care patients will receive with a yes vote on question one on November 6th. By the way, that's a reminder that the election day here is Tuesday. And just for our foreign listeners or people in the United States that are just becoming voting age or whatever, notice you don't get the day off. Notice there's no holiday for elections. Notice that if you want to vote and go to your job and take care of your kids, you might not have time.
Yeah, you got to get up early in the morning, 7.
What if you got to be at work at 7? I got to be at work at 7 on some days. Yeah. So basically you have a typical situation where, oh, those stupid working class Americans just don't vote enough. Liberals love this argument. Get out and vote. Hey, give me the paid time to vote. Make it a holiday. Put it on the weekends, liberals. You know, because they're the ones that are most obnoxious about the vote. Republicans don't want a lot of people to vote. Democrats want a certain number to vote. They don't actually want a lot of people to vote either, but they want more than Republicans do. And so, okay, system, corporate political parties, give us a holiday, give us weekend voting, whatever. Instead, they're finding ways, like the Republicans in Georgia are finding ways to knock people off the ballot based on racist stuff, you know, left and right. Democrats in certain cities have onerous rules about, in a lot of cities, including where I live, you must fill out a census to stay registered, each year.
Cambridge is the same way.
Every 2 years.
I had to fill that out. I went there, I protested, and it's like, what part are you? I'm S.
Yeah.
What is that? It's socialist.
Yeah.
How many times I have to tell you? Come on.
I'm a socialist, too.
I have to go there personally.
Yeah, I'm registered as a socialist, too. And you can do that in Massachusetts. It's a political designation. It doesn't give you any sort. There's no mass socialist party here to have a primary or anything, but it gives you a political designation. And I usually get the same reaction, but this time I didn't. I called City Hall in my town, and I said, am I registered to vote? And they just checking. And they go, yes, because I knew I was, but I wanted to make sure. And they said, they started like talk about like what it said on the form, and I said, "Yeah, that S is for socialist." She goes, "Yeah, socialist." Yeah, it's like no problem this time. They're getting used to it, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so this leaflet says about the Massachusetts hospital industry. Massachusetts hospitals generate $28 billion in revenue each year. Hospitals posted $7.6 billion in profits for the last 5 years. Now, as Americans, we're used to getting billions, the term billions thrown at us because that's how big the economy is and so on. But since everyone's not a mathematician, and I'm certainly not, it's hard to wrap your head around what a billion is. A billion is a lot, okay?
It's a lot of millions.
A real lot. Yeah, a lot of millions.
It's what the lottery won. This guy won in North Carolina, man. It's almost a billion.
Billion is so big. That when you see a billion,
I have a question.
You should say that company automatically, I don't care what you say, has no problem affording everything that we want it to afford. Sorry, go ahead.
Generally speaking, the lottery there was almost a billion, right?
Yeah.
Someone asked me, if you won that money, what would you do? I said, I would invest it in real estate. I'm not going to die with that money and take it with me. I would invest it in real estate for the homeless.
Oh.
It's impossible. I'm like, what do you mean it's impossible? Wrap you around the number almost a billion.
Wait, who said that?
My cousin.
Okay, all right. Is that the guy that works as a manager in Rite Aid or something?
No, now he works for Polar.
Is that drink. Better? Does he go out to Worcester?
No, he goes everywhere.
Worcester has a big Polar facility.
That's where he's from. That's the guy I was talking about that lives in Worcester.
I got to talk to him so bad. Polar needs a union so bad.
So I said to him, yeah, why not? Why? I mean, it could be possible. It's just not possible. I'm like, why is it not possible? You know, you got countries that have less homelessness than this country. There's a reason for it.
Well, I kind of agree with him. It's not possible in the sense of the capitalists wouldn't stand for it. They just wouldn't stand for it. They'd find a way to mess up your plan.
Right.
Basically.
They would, right?
They would. They would pass laws against it or something. Oh, our zoning laws don't allow that many new structures for homeless
people. But if I give you the money, shut up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they still would. It's really...
It's about power. It's not about the money.
Well, there's
right?
a great film. I don't know if it's a great film. There's a film in the 1930s. I think it was called The Great McGinty or something like that.
The Gambit?
No. Oh, okay. Great McGinty. And it's about a rich guy... And parts of this, you know, it's the 30s, so parts of the film are disturbing in terms of the assumptions of the time about, there's a kind of implicitly racist thing going on, not overtly, but implicitly. Women don't have the same rights and all that. So it's the 30s, right? So I'm not defending every aspect of the film. But it had this trajectory, this plot trajectory. It was very interesting. Rich guy, through a series of accidents and stuff happening, ends up at a forced labor prison in the South, for real, like chain gang type thing. And he learns, he just learns how to identify with working class and poor people, which he never had to deal with before, through really hard, horrible hardship, and he survives. He goes back, they get him out, he goes back, he's got all this money waiting for him, his old life waiting for him. So he immediately takes the money, right, and goes, does sort of what you're talking about. He goes to a hobo, they used to call hobo encampments, but homeless encampment, this is the 30s, Hoovervilles, right? Pretty soon we're going to have Trumpvilles or whatever. He goes out and gives the money away. But the minute he starts doing that, he's rushed by a mob. And then something happens where he drops a lot of the money, and there's a scene of the wind blowing all the money away to show, artistically, metaphorically, still not enough. Still the money just goes.
Wow, that's a great film.
Oh, it's a great film, yeah.
A lot of communists writing the Hollywood Ten.
So like he ends up it's kind of a liberal cop-out at the end where he's sort of like, I'll try to make my mark through making movies that people like. Because when he was in prison, what helped him survive is one night they showed a cartoon to the prisoners, and the prisoners just like were laughing, and just that moment of joy stuck with him. And he wants to make movies, you know, and so it kind of squares off in a way I don't like. He's not going to become a political activist, let's say. He's not going to give his money to the Communist Party of the time or whatever. He's going to, you know, make films or whatever. And a lot of people come to that. And in America, a lot of people, like, I knew this famous Canadian. I knew her a little bit. We weren't friends or anything, but I kind of knew her politically through political involvement and through a friend of hers. I'm going to leave her anonymous. I don't want to say bad things about her. But she's really famous in Canada. And she was a really good political activist. And then I lost touch with her, and I read later an article just like what I'm saying now. She goes, well, I discovered that my best contribution is through film. But it's basically saying I retreat from the political arena because it's really messy and hard and difficult to organize people. And I'm going to just do films now, you know. Maybe she's still doing politics. That's one reason I don't want to say who it is just to misrepresent her. But that happens a lot in the U.S. where there's no mass. And she's Canada, a little bit different. She could become, I think she would have room politically in Canada to stay very active politically if she wanted to. But it's still tough up there. But here in the U.S., for example, a lot of people take those kind of, well, here's my contribution is art or charity or something, because they don't want to get into the hard slog of like building a third party for working people. It's just too, they think it's too difficult. They don't want to get into the hard slog of building a mass movement and all the energy you need and the fighting and how do you deal with the cops and how do you deal with everything else, you know. That stuff's hard. Organizing is difficult. They're organizing unions. All this stuff is very hard in the United States because a lot of it is the lack of a political party that workers can turn to and put pressure on the system through that political party. Democrats don't fit that bill. Democrats are part of the system. So it's very hard to do basic political organizing in the United States, and people often just give up. I've seen it a million times, and go try to do something else, and they try to make that equivalent to political organizing. It's not. I'm sorry, you're not doing your art, your charity.
So if I stop homelessness,
your bike riding.
If I hit the lotto, which probably won't happen, but
no, I was just saying about that. They find a way around it. But I was just saying,
but haven't you met people? Interesting question. I'm like, yeah, that's what I would do. Obviously, I would take maybe a couple millions for myself and the family, but then the rest, I mean, geez.
Homelessness in the U.S. that it would take, say they gave you a green light.
Or would it be like a program I would start where it would go into, okay, you got that money.
It would make a difference.
What does Harvard do with this money? An endowment.
Yeah.
That it grows.
Yeah.
And with that endowment,
yeah,
it continues, the foundation.
Well, that's, okay, so you bring up an interesting thing. It's predicated upon.
But it would be consumed by the system, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. It would be consumed by the system. And part of that consumption by the system, so to speak, would be that you're assuming a certain way to... If that money's being invested in other things to make more money, that's part of the system, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing...
We're always intertwined.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought when I first started working at Harvard, for example... I thought, well, at least I'm working in education and I don't have blood on my hands. It's like I'm working for GE or something, building, you know, missiles or aircraft.
Or Raytheon.
Like they do in in nearby Lynn or whatever. But that's a joke. I was wrong. I was didn't understand. I very quickly did understand, but I didn't understand when I had that thought that, wait a minute, Harvard has this endowment and money's outside the endowment that they invest in businesses. And those businesses are just big businesses, part of the system. Anything from energy, like oil production, to you know, wood production, to real estate, things that have to do with the military in terms of high tech, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. Every corporation is linked to every other corporation. They're part of the system, you know? And you can't have a clean corporation, either in the sense we were talking earlier about a green corporation. They can't do that. They'll go be forced out of business. That's the problem with co-ops. There's people that... I was at a conference recently where someone stood up and started talking about, the answer is co-ops, co-ops, co-ops. Well, if a co-op is going to survive, it's surviving in under capitalism. If it's going to survive under capitalism, it's going to have to conform sooner or later to capitalist norms, or it will be driven out of business, either through market pressures or through outright takeover, you know, if it ever goes, if it ever issues stock. Now, why do companies issue stock? To get more money to invest, to survive. Or to prevail, or to dominate, you know what I mean? Because they can't raise that much money privately. So there's no way, so the co-ops, what happens with co-ops is they either conform to capitalism, and then they're just capitalist things pretending to be co-ops, or pretending to be progressive somehow, or they're co-ops that have a very short lifespan, because they're about to get eaten up. The food co-op, for example, in Central Square, that law and JP, that long ago gave up the whole co-op notion. I mean, there was a time back in the 80s where you could like work for it, get a sharp, big discount on food, and that's who ran the place. And then at a certain point, they brought in a business model, say no more working for the co-op. We will hire directly, and they hired cheapest labor they could.
Yeah, I was there once. Yeah. I was there before 9/11.
Yeah. So that's completely gone. But that,
and I said, where's the co-op part here? Where's my discount?
Yeah.
Why you even have co-op? I feel like I'm just a worker. I'm not.
You were.
A computer.
You were.
And they're like, you shut up and just shut up. Like, what?
And how many co-ops would you have to challenge the economic power of capitalism for real? Think about it. You're going to take on ExxonMobil. You're going to take on Amazon. You're going to take on Walmart. What dream planet are you living on? You can't hollow out capitalism. The capitalists are around. That's their game. It's their system. It's their territory. You can't hollow out capitalism.
It's got to be bottom up.
It's got to be defeat. It's got to be overthrow capitalism and start a new system. You cannot use capitalism. What you can use from capitalism is some of the knowledge,
the means of production,
some of the technology.
Yep.
You can take the means of production. We have to run in a completely different way. It's got to be run for human need on a democratically planned, with a democratic plan of production internationally. You're not going to get that. You're going to have competition. You have competition between capitalists within one country, not to mention competition between capitalists using nation states to compete with each other. I mean, co-ops aren't going to make a dent in that, and they haven't. They're just, it's a failed thing. But people are still, co-ops, because they don't want to do that hard organizing where they realize, oh, wow, this is going to have to be a revolution. It's going to have to be a revolution against capitalism where a new system is organized for human needs and not for profit.
That's
you can't.
Like
human
bourgeoisie
needs
found
and profits
out,
are not compatible.
That's like the bourgeoisie found out. No, this feudalist system's got to go.
Yep.
For us to, you know.
But how they found it out?
Next
how they found it out was not the way we are. That's the difference about socialism. Socialism is organizing the people. The bourgeois, they organized people, but for their own ends in a very manipulative way, and they also did it in a very messed up way. Like they had a lot of bourgeois revolutions were tied up to nation states and creating a nation state, you know, where one didn't exist.
So
like, say, you mentioned Morocco. So, for example, let's take Italy or Germany. They brought together different countries, actually, into one country. Happened in the United States, too, actually. But they did that to solidify their capitalist economic system, you know, and they intertwined, like, you know, nationalism with the economy. So socialists, at least good socialists, are internationalists. They're not trying to make one country rich at the expense of another. They're trying to create equality.
A cooperative.
Yeah, and a plan of production around the world, not based on, again, profits for
just like if Germany was socialist and communist at the time and it had been successful in the 20s, they would have had an ally, the Soviet Union, that would have been would have prevented World War II.
That's funny you should mention that. My son was asking me about World War I today. And out of the blue, because, you know, he doesn't like necessarily hear me talk a long time. So I think he took that risk. And so we had a nice talk about World War One and World War Two. And, you know, World War One, which is really worth studying with a magnifying glass. And it often gets in the United States glossed over for World War Two, you know, and that people, there's a little bit of studying World War Two, but not much of World War One usually. There are exceptions to that, thank goodness. But World War One is really worth a study, because that is exactly where there's less distraction from the fact that it's just a straight up war for capitalism, for colonies, for market share, and it was that kind of also the technocrats' dream come to nightmare. You know how, like, you can at any moment turn on the corporate media and hear some guy going on, this new invention is going to solve this robotics and automation, it's going to do this, this, and this. Yeah, what that did in World War One was create more bloody ways to kill people, and they implemented and experimented on soldiers, you know, working class people, to do that. The chemical warfare, the tanks, the planes, bombardment for the first time, you know, all that sort of stuff. And
the rapid machine guns.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Like,
yeah. So World War One is like textbook capitalist war for profit. World War II was that too, but it's harder to get around the monstrosity and evil of fascism, to see what the roots of fascism are under and they are capitalist, and how that was used with Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, others, the Japanese emperor and all that stuff. So and I understand that. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, you do want to study the rise of fascism and Hitlerism and all that, and figure that stuff out as much as you can, but it's not just a psychological study, or hardly at all a psychological study. It's a study of historical materialist proportions, of what economic interests funded the early Nazi party and allowed it to become a mass party, where'd all that money come from, what companies traded with the Nazis even during the war. There's a lot of research about that.
JP Morgan, you got
Coca-Cola,
Fanta.
I think it's energy companies, yeah. So you figure out BMW?
No, the computer business
IBM?
Machine. IBM.
Yeah. Yep. And then you figure out like the other countries, how they acted and why, and what their economic interests were behind the governments in terms of the capitalists running the governments and so on. And you get this big picture in World War II of some of the same, you know, self-serving economic stuff that was happening during World War One, but it's all hidden behind, well, Hitler was such a monster, or Japan was so strong that, you know, all bets are off, we could do whatever we want, from the U.S. imperialism or British or French imperialism. And World War II has this whole heroic mythology around it that, I mean, it's justified in terms of individual commitments in a lot of cases, but not justified in terms of what was really propelling the war into existence and to keep what kept it going, and what the goals were of the ruling classes after the war. You know, that's all questions that can be answered only through a materialist, you know, view of actually dialectic materialist view of what happened with the war. Anyway, we got to do a time check here. We're going to bounce out of that discussion right now. Give our legal ID. We are WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. We also call ourselves Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Free Form Commercial Free Community-Based Radio, another name. And we're a little slice of that community-based. You're listening to socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. So let's jump back to the Yes on One referendum, where hospitals stashed nearly $1 billion in the Cayman Islands and other offshore tax havens. 20% of mass hospitals are owned by for-profit healthcare companies. 15% are owned by Wall Street investment banks. Almost all hospitals are part of large corporate healthcare networks, and very few remain truly independent hospitals. The industry is spending billions more on hospital expansion and construction projects. The industry is inventing hundreds of millions of dollars to purchase hospitals and entire hospital systems in other states and outside the U.S. The Boston Globe and the Boston Business Journal recently reported 50 to 73% pay hikes for hospital CEOs, with $2 million to $4 million salaries the norm. Why doesn't my neighbor down the street, whose house is pretty crappy, mine is too, but even crappier than mine, have a no sign out? Oh, no on one. You know? There are working class people that are that are believing this propaganda, and it's driving me crazy because they're basically helping their exploiters. And again, it comes back down to the lack of a mass workers' party in this country that can have the money to put out alternative media that you'll actually get access to, actually hear more than the bits and